listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Nearly 8 years after he was dragged from the presidential palace at gunpoint by French troops, the former president of Cote d'Ivoire, Laurent Gbagbo, was declared not guilty by the International Criminal Court of all charges that followed from the 2010 presidential election. According to the Constitutional Council, which under Cote d'Ivoire's constitution was the final authority on election outcomes, then incumbent President Gbagbo had won the 2010 election over the former IMF official, Alassane Ouattara. Nevertheless, Western countries, including the former colonial power France, disagreed, and Ouattara was installed and Gbagbo arrested. This was the court at The Hague issuing its final determination on the case on Tuesday.
The majority of Trial Chamber 1, Judge Herrera Cabucha dissenting, notes as follows. First, it is a matter of public record that in the period under scrutiny by the chamber, i.e. November 2010, April 2011, Ivory Coast was torn by a violent political conflict in the context of the presidential elections in Abidjan and in other parts of the country. On June 23, 2011, the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court requested authorization to investigate whether crimes within the jurisdiction of the court were committed in the context of this conflict. And on 3 October 2011, Pretrial Chamber 1 of the International Criminal Court authorized such investigations. Following requests by the Office of the Prosecutor of 25 October 2011 for Mr. Gbagbo and 12 December 2011 for Mr. Bligodé, Pretrial Chamber 1 issued warrants of arrest against the accused on 23 November and 21 December 2011, respectively. Mr. Laurent Gbagbo was surrendered to the International Criminal Court on 30 November 2011, and Mr. Charles Bligodé on 22nd March 2014. The charges against the two accused were confirmed by Pretrial Chamber 1 of the ICC for Laurent Gbagbo on 12 June 2014 and for Charles Bligodé on 11 December 2014. Following the joinder of the two cases and a period for its preparation, the trial commenced on 26 January 2016 before this Trial Chamber 1. The chamber set for 231 hearing days, receiving evidence from 82 prosecution witnesses in court and through video link. Thousands of documents were submitted into evidence. Hundreds of submissions, motions, requests by the parties and participants, and decisions by the chamber were filed. Following the conclusion of the presentation of evidence by the prosecutor, the chamber was seized of requests for the acquittal and immediate release of both accused. Pending the resolution of these requests, the chamber convened a hearing to discuss the continued detention of the accused on 13 December 2018. During this hearing, both accused asked to be released with or without conditions. The chamber, having thoroughly analyzed the evidence and taken into consideration all legal and factual arguments submitted both orally and in writing by the parties and participants, finds by majority that there is no need for the defense to submit further evidence as the prosecutor has not satisfied the burden of proof in relation to several core constitutive elements of the crimes as charged. In particular, the majority finds that the prosecutor has failed to demonstrate that there was a common plan to keep Mr. Gbagbo in power, which included the commission of crimes against civilians, has failed to demonstrate the existence of the alleged policy to attack the civilian population on the basis of the alleged pattern of violence and other circumstantial evidence cited in support, has failed to demonstrate that the crimes as alleged in the charges were committed pursuant to or in furtherance of a state or organizational policy to attack the civilian population, has failed to demonstrate that public speeches for Mr. Gbagbo or Mr. Bligodé, by Mr. Gbagbo or Mr. Bligodé, constituted ordering, soliciting, or inducing the alleged crimes, or that either of the accused otherwise knowingly or intentionally contributed to the commission of such crimes. The Chamber will provide its fully and detailed reasoned decision as soon as possible. The Chamber recognizes that it would have been preferable to issue the full decision at this time. However, Rule 144(2) of the Rules of Procedure and Evidence states that the Chamber must provide copies of its full decision, and I quote, as soon as possible after pronouncing its decision in a public hearing, and there is no specific time limit in this regard. The majority is of the view that the need to provide the full reasoning at the same time of the decision is outweighed by the Chamber's obligation to interpret and apply the Rome Statute in a manner consistent with internationally recognized human rights as required by Article 21(3) of the Statute. Indeed, an overly restrictive application of Rule 144(2) would require the Chamber to delay the pronouncement of the decision, pending completion of a full and reasoned written statement of its findings on the evidence and conclusions. But given the volume of evidence and the level of detail of the submissions of the parties and participants, the majority, having already arrived at its decision upon the assessment of the evidence, cannot justify maintaining the accused in detention during the period necessary to fully articulate its reasoning in writing. The deadline for appealing the present decision will start running at the moment the parties are notified of the full reasons for it. The prosecutor may seize the Chamber of a request under Article 81(3)(i) as of today. For all these reasons, the Chamber, by majority, hereby decides that the prosecutor has failed to satisfy the burden of proof to the requisite standard as foreseen in Article 66 of the Rome Statute. Grants the defense motions for acquittal from all charges against Mr. Laurent Gbagbo and Mr. Charles Blegoudet. Orders the immediate release of both accused pursuant to Article 81(3). No! Come on! Please! Can you? Please, I appeal to the public. Please sit down. Otherwise, I have to evacuate. Please sit down and please behave. Okay. Ordered the immediate release of both accused pursuant to Article 81(3)(c) of the statute, subject to any request by the prosecutor under subparagraph i of this article.
That outburst that was heard in the court when the verdict was announced came from supporters of the former president. According to the Associated Press, his supporters had also been singing and dancing outside the courthouse and in the streets of the capital of Cote d'Ivoire, Abidjan. The former president is considering whether or not to run again for the presidency, according to Reuters. If that happens, the sitting president, Ouattara, may run, although he had announced in August that he would not. This past Friday, some of the other war zones around the world, including Yemen, Syria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Central African Republic, Libya, and Ukraine were discussed by the spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, Stéphane Dujarric, at his daily press conference.
Good afternoon. Happiest of Fridays. I'll start off with a humanitarian note on Yemen. The Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Mark Lowcock, and the Executive Director of the World Food Program, David Beasley, today announced that $32 million will be allocated from the Central Emergency Response Fund to help scale up life-saving operations in Yemen. The funds will allow WFP to ramp up humanitarian logistical operations, including increases in humanitarian air cargo, transport more humanitarian workers, provide more accommodation spaces, including in Hodeidah, and expand emergency telecommunications. The funds will also support the work of the UN agencies as well as NGOs engaged in the humanitarian relief operations. Mr. Beasley said that the World Food Program is going to help 12 million people a month, up from 8 million currently. Mr. Lowcock said that to avert the worst in Yemen, all parties to the conflict must facilitate rapid unimpeded passage of humanitarian relief for civilians in need. They both welcome the recent decisions taken in Sana'a to provide more visas for humanitarian workers, to investigate allegations of theft of food aid, and to punish those responsible, as well as to ban the sale of food aid intended for Yemenis with no income, and to put in place more effective targeting and monitoring systems. Excuse me. Turning to Syria, the special envoy for Syria, Geir Pedersen, had good meetings with the International Syria Support Group task forces yesterday, focusing on humanitarian issues in Rubkan, Idlib, and Northeast. He remains committed to the protection of civilians and expressed deep concern about the attacks on humanitarians. He said he was pleased to hear from Russia and Turkey on their sustained commitment to maintaining stability in Idlib. As directed by the Secretary General, the Special Envoy continues his consultations with concerned parties within and outside of Syria towards a peaceful solution and the implementation of Security Council Resolution 2254. And today, the UN Refugee Agency said it is deeply concerned by reports of mounting civilian casualties, including many women and children, and large-scale civilian displacement amid renewed fighting in the Hajin enclave in Deir ez-Zor Governorate in the eastern part of the country over the past 6 months. Clashes and airstrikes in the southeast part of the governorate forced 25,000 people to flee, as well as women and children. Many elderly people are at risk. And an estimated 2,000 people remain in the conflict-affected areas of Hajin, those fleeing report increasingly desperate conditions with diminishing services and extremely high prices for basic food. We're all worried for civilians who continue to be trapped in the Daesh-held areas. And this morning, the head of the UN peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Leila Zerugi, briefed Security Council members following yesterday's announcement of the provisional election results, focusing on the ongoing electoral process, which she said was in the final stretch. She commended the Congolese people for exercising their democratic right to vote and for their commitment to the political process. The Secretary General's representative said the coming days will be critical to the conclusion of the historic electoral process, adding she will continue to engage with all Congolese stakeholders to reinforce the need for calm and recourse to established judicial procedures. A full remarks are online. And our colleagues at the UN peacekeeping mission in the Central African Republic have just told us that they are on the ground there. The mission is conducting operation to restore order in Bambari in Waka Prefecture in coordination with the Central African Republic's own security forces. The operation was launched yesterday in response to ongoing attacks by the armed group UPC against the local population and peacekeepers. According to our peacekeepers on the ground, UN troops seized weapons and lethal equipment and removed barracks. The mission strongly condemns violence against civilians and calls on all parties to engage in dialogue, especially within the context of the upcoming African Union peace talks in Khartoum on the 24th of January. And the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Libya, Maria Ribeiro, has today expressed deep concern over the escalation of hostilities in the eastern city of Derna and the consequent further deterioration of humanitarian situation in parts of the city. Intense fighting recently resulted in substantial civilian casualties in Derna and the deterioration of infrastructure and services, as well as civilian population lacking access to basic needs, including food, water, and urgent life-saving medical care for the wounded. Ms. Ribeiro called for unconditional, unimpeded, and sustained humanitarian access to the affected civilians in the Old City. And urged all parties to the conflict to take all measures to protect civilians and civilian facilities and to strictly follow their obligations under international humanitarian and human rights law. And the UN Resident Coordinator for Ukraine, Osnat Lubrani, said she's concerned about three water workers being injured after their car came under fire in the country's east. Ms. Lubrani said it was unacceptable that water workers face lethal risks in carrying out their normal duties and ensuring that water continues to flow to millions of people. This latest incident brings to 11 the total number of water workers injured in the past 9 months. Ms. Lubrani stressed that any targeting of civilian workers or infrastructure or intentional disruption of access to water supply and heating systems is a clear violation of international humanitarian law. I pause here before turning over to Monica.
Thanks, Steph. My question is about Yemen and three things. The first one, could you confirm if the talks are going to take place in Jordan or not? And when, if you have now a date? And the second point regarding the Yemeni government is saying that they are not going to go to talks unless they have control over Hodeidah. So, and can you elaborate on this? What's your standpoint regarding this? And as for aid, you have Mr. Lokak, when he talks 2 days ago, he said that about 5% or about 95% of the aid gets to the right people, but about 5% is not getting to the Yemeni or the people in need. So which measures are you taking now to make sure that you are getting there? Thank you.
Sure. Let me take your question in the reverse order. In discussions with the authorities in Sana'a, our humanitarian colleagues were pleased to know that they are increasing, that they've banned the sale of humanitarian aid that is meant for those who receive no income. There are increased procedures that have been agreed to by the government, I think including biometrics, which helps us track the aid, and investigations will be going on. I think when you're distributing aid in what essentially is a conflict zone, there will always be some issues about aid getting to the right people. It is our own responsibility in partnership with the local authorities to ensure that those in need get the aid. I think there is something particularly atrocious about stealing humanitarian aid for those who need it the most. Your second question, Mr. Griffiths is been traveling around. He's also talking to the parties as well as every staff. Mr. Kammert is very much engaged on the ground in Hodeidah in trying to operationalize the Stockholm Agreement. What is important is that all the parties cooperate with the UN to help move the process forward, to ensure that, the relative calm that we see in Hodeidah can be solidified, spread to other places in the country, because that's something we've been calling for quite some time, and engage in the political process that Mr. Griffiths is leading. I'm not able to confirm any dates on talks. I think we've seen various reports. I would disregard those reports if I were you. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Stefan. I know it's UNHCR, but can you confirm that the Saudi woman in Thailand was granted asylum by Canada? That's what
Again,
the Thai officials are saying.
I mean, I haven't gotten any update from UNHCR. We can give you their number here, but I cannot confirm. Mr. Bays.
It's a follow-up on Yemen talks. The special envoy, I'm told the Security Council in consultations that the next stage, even though there may be talks on prisoner exchange, potentially in Jordan, the next stage of the political talks now have slipped until February. Is the Secretary General concerned about a loss of momentum in this process?
What the Secretary General would like to see is the consolidation of what we've been able to achieve in Hodeidah, the parties working closely with Mr. Kamhert to live up to their obligations and to operationalize in Hodeidah. This has been a long road, a lot of ups and downs. I think we're pleased with what is happening right now, but we need to move forward. We need to solidify what is happening on the ground. We have our responsibilities. All the parties involved have their responsibilities, as well as those who have influence on the parties involved.
Thank you, Stefan. I asked yesterday about this letter from the Moroccan permanent representative, and I saw the letter. It contains some alleged violations by Polisario in the Gergerat area. Can MINURSO or the UN confirm those violations? And I have a question also whether you have any comment on the start of the U.S. Troops withdrawal from Syria. Thank you.
No, I don't have a particular comment on that. On Western Sahara, as you've seen the letter, I can confirm that we've received the letter from Morocco alleging violations of the ceasefire and related agreements in Western Sahara. As you know, there is an established procedure for assessing such allegations by either party undertaken by the UN mission on the ground based on the impartial monitoring and observation functions of our colleagues in Western Sahara. The UN mission, MINURSO, was present at both of these alleged incidents and did not observe anything amounting to a violation under the terms of the applicable agreements. Incidents or issues which are identified as being violations of the applicable agreements are shared with the parties for their immediate action, a process which has been effective in preventing conflict and maintaining the ceasefire since its inception. Such violations are also reported to the Security Council as part of the mission's normal reporting procedures. Let's go to a different place in the world.
Actually, not so much. I have a follow-up on Syria.
Ah, okay. Sorry.
It's been reported today that the U.S. began some level of withdrawal from Syria. So due to these reports, could you remind us first, what's the view of the SG on the importance on keeping the fight against terrorism and whether or not the SG believes that the withdrawal of the U.S. poses a risk to the overall goals that the U.N. has set on fighting terrorism?
I'm not going to comment on reports of a U.S. military withdrawal. We're not briefed or informed. Our focus remains the work of Mr. Pedersen. I need to get used to that. The work of Mr. Pedersen in his lead to try to get a political settlement. As you saw, he's already deep into it, meeting with various stakeholders. As for the fight against terrorism, our position has always been that the fight against terrorism needs to take into full respect the protection of civilians and international humanitarian and human rights law. Mr. Klein.
Yes, I want to go back to the Congo. I know you've indicated that the UN is not in the position to comment on the fairness of the election. But at the Security Council meeting today, Belgium and I believe some other members have suggested that there be a detailed release down to the precinct level of the voting tallies, comparisons with the National Episcopalian Conference tallies. Does the Secretary General have any comment on the issue of transparency, and whether does he believe that that suggestion of detailed release and analysis and comparisons of the different voting tallies should take place?
Look, I think I've used quite a few words on our position on the election. We're not going to dictate to the Congolese authorities. It's Congolese own process. What is important is that calm prevail, and that the established constitutional and legal procedures be followed. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Stefan. Can you confirm, with regard to Palestine, can you confirm that the Secretary General will meet President Abbas when he visits New York next week?
Yes, he will be meeting with Mr. Abbas. Masoud, I'm sorry.
Stefan, can you does the Secretary General agree with what his special envoy has said about North Korea, that it's a prison without walls and so forth? And that press conference was widely reported and reported from
Seoul. I'm not aware of the Secretary General having a special envoy on North Korea.
No, this this Human United Nations Human Rights Envoy who was supposed to visit
the special rapporteur, on human rights in North Korea has a specific mandate. You know, special rapporteurs operate outside of the control of the Secretary General. They work for the Human Rights Council. It's not for us to comment on what they say. What is important is that the Secretary General has expressed in the past his concern for the human rights situation in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And he has, as a matter of principle, he encourages all countries to cooperate fully with all the special procedures of the Human Rights Council.
But does the Secretary General necessarily agree or not agree with this?
I think I've tried to the best of my English-speaking ability to answer your question.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. President Donald Trump has repeatedly said the U.S. will withdraw from Syria. It would seem he's the only one in his administration backing this move. Is Trump in charge of his own foreign policy? Are John Bolton and Mike Pompeo actually running the show? Cross-talking Trump's Syria policy, I'm joined by my guest, Sabah al-Mukhtar in London. He is a lawyer and an independent political analyst, as well as an expert in Iraqi affairs. In Damascus, we have Amar Wyckoff. He is founder and director of Nosos, an organization expressing stakeholder opinion in Syria and in the Middle East. And in Norman, we cross to Joshua Landis. He is the director of the Center of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Joshua, let me go to you first in Norman. I have a very simple question, but I don't think there's a simple answer. Trump's foreign policy is befuddling, frustrating to understand, and it seems quite fluid. So what do you make of his policy as his major foreign policy advisors, including the U.S. Secretary of State, is essentially contradicting their boss on their Middle East tour? Go ahead, Joshua.
Well, you're absolutely right. And for Americans, it's just as confusing as it is for the rest of the world, because the foreign policy elite really has come undone. And the way this process is hammered out has now been thrown into some chaos because the president has taken charge of the Syrian issue himself. And that started in December 14th when the Turks escalated. They threatened to invade and were bombarding northern Syria. This forced an escalation beyond the sort of the top State Department and National Security Council people, and the president took a phone call to Erdogan, at which point he said, we're pulling out. This was news to the foreign policy elite who wanted to stay in Syria to counter Iran and roll back Iran. So that threw everything into chaos. Yeah. Then they immediately sort of rolled back Trump's statements, and now Trump has come on again and said, we are going to leave. And he's gearing up for a national campaign in 2020 in which he wants to promise the people that he's going to end these stupid wars the way he did several years ago. And so we're at a crossroads here on the Syrian policy, and there is a lot of confusion.
You know, Saba, it can be all nice and fine if Donald Trump and his advisors want to have this charade played out in public. Fine. OK, Donald Trump is a person that easily changes his mind or he says something different, contradicting himself. That's all nice and fine. We're used to it. But the region isn't. The Turks don't know how to react. The Damascus government is confused. The Russians are confused. The Iranians are confused. And lo and behold, the American people finally found out who the Kurds are because of all of this. So it's just not the confusion in Washington. It's creating confusion all through the region. Go ahead, Saba in London.
Well, quite frankly, I think the Americans never had a policy. They wanted to have a regime change in Syria. That's as far as they can think of. Anything else after that, I don't think anybody knew on the American side. They have no idea about the Kurdish problem. They don't know the differences between the various Kurdish factors. They don't know anything about the so-called ISIS and the other Islamist terrorist groups. They don't know anything about the Syrian Free Army. But they are the power that has the power. It has the airplane. It has the voice that can make. And it can threaten Turkey. And they've actually did so a little while ago when they imposed economic problems for Turkey. So the confusion is right from the outset. At the outset, they wanted to change the regime. Then they decided they want somebody else to do that. And then after that, they decided, well, it's been weakened enough, so let's leave it now as it is. This is how I would describe the American policy. As far as the administration is concerned, you have a president who is unique in the United States of America, where he is taking the lead into things which he doesn't know anything about it. He keeps on telling lies. He's the only president that the American public and the media is counting the lies he is telling. He says one thing and he says another thing. Then you have the right-wingers within the administration who know a little bit where they want to go. They know they are against the Iranians. They want to support Israel. They are against Assad. And probably they are against the Russians. This is how they view it. So, of course, you have this confusion. But at the end of the day, I don't think the Syrian issue has changed from the beginning until now. Assad continuing to kill the people, and the people want to revolt against it.
Okay, let's go to Damascus. Amar, I think I'm sure you read Mike Pompeo's Cairo speech. It's one of the most bizarre things I've ever read in my life. I'm not sure what region he's talking about in the world, but it certainly wasn't the Middle East, okay? And it was, for the most part, about three things. Iran. It's really quite puzzling to try to understand what that foreign policy from the White House and from the State Department, what direction they really want to go to. Really, and he did not address many important issues, the Palestinians, Khashoggi, calling Saudi Arabia to live, the Iranians to live up to the human rights standards of Saudi Arabia. What is going on with this administration? Go ahead in Damascus.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the United States will always be seeking more influence and more stable and strategic influence in the Middle East. They're currently threatened by some Russian expansion because of the American policy in Syria, which, you know, created the circumstances for a Russian increased influence in the region. Now, very traditional allies of the United States, very established allies, are not only talking more to Russia, but they're also having all these, even weaponry, like in the Turkish example. So, in the case of Iran, the United States probably thinks that having Iran as a sole enemy would gather as much allies on one front along with the United States as possible. Definitely Israel would be interested in any American anti-Iran policy in the region. The Saudis would, the bulk of the Gulf states, probably apart from Qatar at the moment. Turkey would traditionally be in competition with Iran, and so on and so forth. So this is not new. This has been happening all along. But we need to understand that what is going on at the moment is that probably some people in the United States, and definitely a lot of people in Israel, are thinking this is the right time to pass or to make some progress on the what we can call perhaps the Zionist project. So let us push any anti-Zionist project sentiment as possible towards despair, and let's make good of any alliance with some Arab states against Iran and turn Iran into an enemy. And the United States, with some lobbying inside the administration, would probably want that to happen. But at the end of the day, the main issue is that the United States feels that its influence may be dwindling a little bit. Its allies, traditional allies, may be looking eastwards at the moment towards the likes of Russia and China.
On that point, I would definitely agree with you here. Joshua, the issue between the United States and Turkey in northern Syria vis-a-vis the Kurds has not been resolved. And this, I really fault American media and Western media in general. They don't look at the other actors and the other players in all of this, because Erdogan is really bet a lot on seeing his policy to come to fruition. And if he doesn't know what the U.S. is going to do, once it understands where the United States or what the United States wants to do, then it can act. And Erdogan is not a man known for his patience. Go ahead, Joshua.
Well, you're absolutely right that the Kurdish problem, it turns out to be a problem for everybody. Nobody really knows what to do with it. Not America, not Turkey, not Syria. Not Iraq. And this is, you know, with the collapse of the Syrian central state during the civil war, Assad, in many ways, handed off eastern, northeastern yep. Syria to the Kurds yep. and to the YPG. Yep. And then America, which had been helping the Arab militias against Assad, hoping to overthrow the regime, put in a pro-American regime that would make peace with Israel, this completely collapsed. And so the United States was left siding with the Kurds to fight ISIS, this virulent Sunni caliphal group that was trying to build this big caliphate. And that caused, in a sense, the United States to side with allies of Assad, if you would. But now that they're withdrawing, none of the regional powers want there to be an independent or autonomous Kurdish entity with its own military. And that is a very difficult problem for the United States to get out, because they want to make sure that their allies don't get completely smashed in the process. And, okay, and this is embarrassing.
Okay, let me stay with you. We're almost going to the break. Joshua, let me stay with you here. But I understand that the various Kurdish groups are in negotiations with Damascus right now to come to some kind of resolution if and when the United States leaves. Go ahead, Joshua. You finish up before we go to the break.
You're absolutely right. And this puts the United States in a very embarrassing position, because it means that if the Kurds and Damascus patch up their relations, form an agreement over bringing the Syrian army back in to this whole northern region, which would be the best thing for the Kurds, it is going to embarrass the United States, because then to fight against ISIS and continue the war, counterterrorism war in the East, the United States effectively has to work with Assad, because the YPG will become part of the Syrian army. And that puts the United States back at square one of reconciling with the Assad regime, even if it's distasteful to them, and working with it effectively. And that's where the United States stands today, as this entire revolution that it promoted and asked for the overthrow of Assad, in a sense, it's discovered that the alternative turned out to be something worse, ISIS or Al-Qaeda or other Islamic groups that the United States didn't want to deal with. And now it's back to square one.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here, gentlemen. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Syria. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Saba in London. Saba, I couldn't help but notice when I was asking questions of Joshua Landis and Norman there, you were disagreeing. Go ahead, elaborate.
That's correct. It's the Kurdish issue. I think everybody is relying on the Kurdish issue as the main cause of all these confusion. And this is not true. The Kurdish issue is a real issue for the Turks, but not for the Americans.
Exactly.
And not even for the Syrians. The Turks, as far as they are concerned, this is a domestic problem which they have to resolve it. America don't even understand the difference between the various Kurds, whether they are in Iraq or in Syria or in Turkey. They don't know the movement, and they are willing to decide. They have a designer-made Kurdish movement. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, just as much as they were doing with the Islamist movement. Some of them are good Muslims and some of them are bad Muslims. This is not the issue. The issue is the Americans started to change the regime. They decided not to because they can't, or for whatever reason. The situation is staying as it is. The Turks are determined. They are not going to allow the Kurdish problem to be an issue for the national security of Turkey, and they are going to use force. They are going to use force even if the Americans stay there. The Americans have to get out for a variety of reasons, including money, because Trump is being saying he wants money. He doesn't want anything other than money. He doesn't care about politics or international or Middle East or anything else. He wants money from the regimes, from everybody else, and he wants money for his services. That's what he's telling the American people, because he cannot offer them what the American people are expecting from him. But on the Syrian scene, I think the situation is as is. It hasn't changed. The Americans are going to withdraw, whether they are slow or fast or whatever. And the Turks are not going to allow the Kurdish movement to start a new country, as happened in the north of Iraq under the watch of the Americans. And this is where the problem is.
Okay, Ahmad, let's go back to Damascus. I mean, it's interesting what Saba was saying, because John Bolton, when he was in Ankara, was publicly humiliated when Erdogan refused to meet with him. And instead, Erdogan took the time to address the Turkish parliament to basically berate Bolton. I think the Western media coverage of this situation here does grossly underestimate how Turkey feels. Now, I don't believe invading a foreign country, a sovereign country, is right. Is a breaking of the international law. But Saba is very right. The Kurds matter not as some kind of political trophy to pass around or give excuses for. It does matter to the Turks. Can you think Damascus and the Kurds come to an agreement where Turkish aggression can be avoided? Go ahead in Damascus.
Well, we don't think that Turkish aggression is inevitable. We need to remember that Turkey isn't working alone on this. They're working with Russia and Iran. And if we go back a few months to September, when they had a summit in Tehran between Putin, Erdogan and Rouhani, they had a statement afterwards in which they said that they refuse Americans changing the facts on the ground under the pretext or umbrella of fighting terrorism, and that these three states would work against this project that basically threatens the integrity and safety of the Syrian and unity of the Syrian territory. And at the same time, and this is the most important point, I think here, it's the national security of neighboring countries. And this is a public statement. They're not, they're a sort of commitment has taken place. So would Turkey, coming from that analogy, would Turkey go alone in northern Syria without a consent from Russia and actually behind the scenes Damascus? We don't think so. But probably all these parties, if we think of them now as a quartet, Russia, Iran, Turkey, and Damascus, Syria, they're probably pushing the Kurds towards, or maneuvering the Kurds towards, lowering their demands when they are talking with Damascus. we think that the Kurds do not really think an autonomy is possible, and definitely the Americans don't think an autonomy is possible in northeastern Syria. So probably what the Americans wish out of this is to avoid a humiliating situation when the Arabs over there, for example, would be so enraged with American presence, think about it as an occupation, that they would actually start attacking U.S. soldiers, and B, probably the United States would want to withdraw swiftly so that they create a vacuum that would lead to conflict between those four parties, Iran, Turkey, Syria, and Russia. Now, that said, the safe way out of this will always be a negotiation with the central government in Damascus. What the Kurds would come out, would bring out of that negotiation is yet to, we're yet to see that, but hopefully it will be good for all the parties.
Okay, well, you know, every time there's a negotiation to end the conflict in Syria, the U.S. seems to upset it. Maybe once it does leave, it'll leave the players on the ground because they have real genuine interests. They can resolve it. Joshua, it's been reported that in September, John Bolton went to the Pentagon and was asking for a menu of ideas how to react militarily to Iran for an alleged terror attack within the Green Line in Baghdad. Does that tell you everything we need to know about John Bolton in the Middle East?
Well, you know, it's not only that, but John Bolton had been, before he got his present job, he was lobbying for regime change in Iraq. He was talking to, regime change in Iran, excuse me. He was talking to big Iranian groups in the United States and saying that he was all in favor of regime change in Iran. So he is very aggressively anti-Iranian, and which I presume is part of the reason that he was brought to the top of the pick for President Trump. So President Trump is sitting on a very anti-Iranian foreign policy crowd. And we say that from Pompeo in his speech in Cairo, as you explained in your opening, which was really a love letter to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, exactly.
He blamed all the problems in the Middle East on Iran. And this is, of course, the anti-Obama policy in some ways, but it's also, it puts the United States in a very small camp. And it's a camp that's very divided because the Gulf Arabs and Israel, which of course America's trying to bring the two together to face off against Iran, they're extremely divided. And we see between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, but none of the Gulf Arabs really trust each other. They're not ready to really combine, and it's a mess. The Middle East is a mess today, and the United States doesn't really know what to do with it.
You know, Saba, let's go back to London. I mean, when Trump made his announcement, the original announcement in December of last year of withdrawing from Syria, it was quickly followed up by lowering the number of troops in Afghanistan. After Trump made his trip to Iraq, not going through the diplomatic procedures, which obviously annoyed the Iraqi government, they too said it's time for American troops or some of them to leave here. I mean, we do have an exodus of one form or another, and it's all of these countries want America to leave. It's interesting that Pompeo said we only go where we're asked to go and we leave when we're told to leave, which is just patently untrue. But there seems to be a movement across this very large region to see a lowering of American military presence in different countries that have different interests. This seems to be a trend, and I think this is what the foreign policy blob is terrified of, because it's this kind of imperial role in the Middle East is the glue that keeps the political class together. If it's Republican or Democrat, they all seem to be in lockstep on that the U.S. should never leave once it's gone somewhere. Go ahead, Saba.
Well, you see, here in Britain, when we were the empire in that region, we knew how to run things. That's the British, not me. The Americans are trying to do the same thing, but they have absolutely no idea how to do this thing. When I go to America, if I tell somebody I'm from London, I have to say London, England, because they think it's some sort of a village in one of the Wyoming state or something. they have no idea about that region. Now, at the present moment, the regimes that are in the Gulf in Jordan, in Egypt, and precisely in Iraq are all protected by the Americans. And Trump is absolutely right in saying we are protecting all of you and we are keeping you there, all of you. This is absolutely correct. America never talks about Iraq. He has 5,000 soldiers in Iraq. That's Trump. He talks about Syria. He talks about Afghanistan. But he never talks about Iraq because under the pretext that he's fighting Iran, he's keeping the American soldiers to protect the regime in Baghdad, which is pro-Iran, which right. is a conflict of... Nobody can understand this idiocy of policies. But as far as the American policy, America no longer has friends other than Israel. And even in Israel, they are beginning, because of Trump's loose talk, every time he talks from the hip and he keeps on sending these tweets and he annoys everybody, even the Israelis are getting annoyed with him. He has no friends in the Middle East. Nobody trusts him anywhere, not even MBS, who has given him $500 billion or $500 trillion of investment. Even he doesn't trust him anymore.
Okay, let me jump in here. We're almost out of time, and I want to go back to Damascus. Amar, what's really interesting, again, it's underreported in Western media, is that essentially Syria has been welcomed back into the Arab League. Gulf countries are opening up their embassies here. I mean, there is a wide acceptance now in the region that the government in Assad will stand and remain. Go ahead, in Damascus.
Yes, I think a lot of people in the region and probably in the West as well, we've heard, for example, from Britain, Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt saying the same. We have to expect President Assad to be there for a while, and we have to work on that. And they congratulated Russia for winning a sphere of influence in Syria, and they thought that this comes with some responsibility and so on. But vis-a-vis the Arabs, it's also a little bit more complicated than what it seems. Perhaps the likes or the axis, now we can probably talk about an axis of Saudi Arabia, UAE, Egypt, Bahrain, they took the first step, they took the initiative to renew relationships with Damascus and bring back Damascus to the Arab fold. The UAE was the first to open its embassy there. The Saudis are...
Okay, Amar, I'm afraid I have to jump in here. We've run out of time, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in London, Damascus, and in Norman. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.